Jim McShann at the piano from an album that is a tribute to Fats Waller, an album on the Sackville record label. In just a moment on Fresh Air, we'll be meeting John Norris, who's the co-owner of Sackville and the co-producer of the record we just heard. In the winter and spring of 1979, a Playboy photographer visited Ivy League colleges looking for women to pose unclothed for a story on girls of the Ivy League. While some women made appointments to get their photos taken, other women protested Playboy's presence on the campus. The Girls of the Ivy League issue is now on the newsstands. This afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, we'll be joined by Laura Kleiber, a student at Penn who posed nude for this feature. She'll talk with us about why she decided to pose and what reactions she's gotten from the published photo and how she feels about the whole story now that it's in print. Fresh Air's arts reviewer Judy Stein will be joining us at her usual Monday time, 3:30. At 4 today, we'll hear from one of the first and most influential documentary filmmakers, Willard Van Dyke, who began making documentaries in the 1930s, when taking the camera from the back lot into a real-life setting was quite a feat, both technically and conceptually. Van Dyke had some trouble with blacklisting in the 1950s. He later spent 9 years as the head of the film department at the Museum of Modern Art. At 4 o'clock today, we'll hear him in conversation with Alan Farley. In the studio with me now is someone whose efforts we've listened to many times here on Fresh Air. My guest is John Norris, who makes many contributions to different aspects of jazz. In Canada, he runs the Jazz and Blues Center, which is a small but very stocked record store. He's the publisher of Coda Magazine, a magazine based in Canada, which is devoted to all aspects of jazz and is funded in part by the Canada Council and the Ontario Arts Council. John Norris is also the co-owner of Sackville Records, which, like Coda, is devoted to different aspects of jazz, including the avant-garde and the mainstream of jazz. John Norris has produced records by people like Dollar Brand, Anthony Braxton, Jay McShann, Oliver Lake, Doc Cheatham, and many others. He's on his way back from a record collectors conference in Washington, D.C., and he's dropping in with us to spend some time with us here on Fresh Air. Welcome to Fresh Air, John.
Thank you, Terry.
I'd like to hear how you got involved with the various aspects of jazz that you work in. What was your interest in it from the start?
Well, In England, I first started listening to jazz music, and I ran a jazz club when I worked. I worked for Shell in England, and I ran a jazz club, and we had a publication, a newsletter. But it was really when I came to North America that I really got involved in doing something about jazz music other than simply listening to it. And I started Coda in 1958. Initially, it was an outlet, an information outlet for a traditional jazz club in Toronto. At that time, the major magazines in North America were not providing very much information about a lot of jazz music other than what was currently popular. And it seemed to me that people needed to know where musicians were playing or if they were playing in different parts of the country. So I started Coda, which was a mimeographed 12-page magazine, which I wrote all of, the first issue, and we printed 200 copies.
21 years is a span that anyone could be proud of. That's a very, very long time. Frequently when you start a business or enter a field or start an endeavor, you have a certain set of ideals of how you want to run the thing, how you think things should be, what changes you'd like to make to the field that you're entering. And then with experience, some of your goals may be altered a little bit. What were your ambitions musically and politically when you got started, and has it changed at all through experience and time?
I would say that when I started, I was a totally unaware and naive young man who simply was fulfilling some kind of, I guess, inner need or motivation in myself, and supplying and providing a service for people who obviously needed, you know, what I was doing. I think that the basic philosophy of the magazine has remained fairly constant, which is to provide information about jazz musicians of all styles through the years, particularly emphasizing musicians who might not be popular at the present time, either new musicians or older musicians who have faded from the limelight. But the emphasis has always been on encouraging people to listen to jazz music, to go out and support the music and support the musicians who make the music, and to support the places that provide music, either live or on record.
I think a lot of times in endeavors like the ones you've begun, people who've already been in the mainstream end of the business for a long time would say, well, that's a great idea, kid, but you can't do it. And once you're in the business for a few years, you realize why that can't be done, and you'll enter the more commercial end where I've been, and you'll agree that there's no other route. Did you get that?
Well, I've always had people say those kind of things to me, but I've never done that. For up until about 1968 or 69, I always had another job. I was putting out Coda, you know, in my living room, and weekends and nights and all this kind of thing. And in 1962, I took a job in a record store, in a big record store in Toronto, and ran the jazz department for 7 or 8 years, which is really where I learnt how to make a living, I guess, out of jazz music, which is something that is extremely difficult to do. But it's no more difficult than making a living out of playing jazz music. And I think that the commercial end of jazz music, or jazz-oriented music, whether you're a musician or somebody who is involved in it, you know, in a writing or producing or whatever, once you take that step to go in that direction, I feel that you move outside of the jazz community. And at least up until very recent times, there was a very strong jazz community, which was started by all the musicians in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, who themselves were isolated from society as a whole. And their way of surviving was to function as an independent community, you know, within society as a whole. And that's how I feel that we've always been.
There was a time when jazz records sold a lot, though, particularly, I guess, during the big bands, when people were dancing to Ellington or Fletcher Henderson. Those were the records that people would go out and buy. It's not quite that way anymore. I'd like you to share with us a little more of your thoughts about the really commercial end of the music industry now, the way the major labels are handling jazz or not handling jazz, depending on how you look at it. Do you see?
Well, first of all, in the 1930s, like Fletcher Henderson and Duke Ellington, for instance, they certainly benefited by the success of Benny Goodman and Tommy Dorsey and Glenn Miller. But of all the most popular bands in the swing era, that was popular music. I don't feel that in essence, was any really different to the Beach Boys or Elvis Presley. Is just a different kind of music, and it was an accident that it was jazz-oriented. And Goodman was the most jazz-oriented of those big bands. And Henderson and Basie and Ellington benefited from just the mass appeal of the music at the time, in the same way that in the 50s, when Dave Brubeck accidentally became a popular musician for a while, other people benefited from that exposure. But today I think it's totally different. The record corporations in the last 10 years have changed the whole music scene. The record scene, I should say, has changed dramatically, to the point where the large record companies take a musician and try to manufacture something, a product that they can sell to a mass audience. And in some cases, they have been successful, people like George Benson and Herbie Hancock and Chick Corea. And what the product that they produce, I no longer feel has anything to do with jazz music. I don't think that most of the records that, for instance, are in the Billboard jazz chart have anything to do with jazz music. In fact, most of those records we don't even stock in our store. And if we do, we can't sell them.
For people like yourself who are involved with the end of a profession that is different from the more commercial mainstream of that profession, you can define yourself as being an alternative institution. And that it's a word that I think has fallen from grace in the past few years. But you can also define yourself as just being completely independent of the commercial end of that. In other words, at this point, use of the word alternative means that you're always seeing yourself as being in reaction to something else. Well, how do you see yourself in relation to the more commercial end of the music industry?
I don't think we have anything to do with them, and except that we need their outlets. Unfortunately, we need their outlets to sell our records. In the last 2 or 3 years, with the a larger percentage of young people being turned off by the products that are being pushed down people's throats, there has been a greater possibility for people to buy jazz records in the large chain stores in North America, and there's been new distributors come into being who have been successful in getting the records into those stores, which in the short term has probably benefited all of us who make jazz records. But if we believe what Billboard is telling us right now is that the record industry is in a profit squeeze, the first records that are going to disappear from all of those chain stores are jazz records. And the real thing that we need to have is a chain, if you like, of specialty stores in different parts of the country that really cater to the needs of people who are interested in the music. For instance, I would suspect that most people over 40 are turned off with the idea of even going into a large record store because there's loud disco music blaring out at them, and they feel alienated in that environment, even if the store has a big selection of Duke Ellington and Count Basie, etc. And then when they get in the store, they go in and they ask the clerk, do you have any, say, Coleman Hawkins records? And the guy says, Coleman who? Or something like that. It's very difficult. And I think that there are a lot of people out there in all parts of the country who could be buying a lot of records, who don't even know that most of them exist even.
You're suggesting a chain of
I'm suggesting that each large city should certainly be able to support a store that caters to the needs of the jazz community. And I think that it could be successful, providing it was properly funded and run as a business. This is the other problem, that most jazz endeavors tend to end up being run by amateurs, people who do it because they love the music but have no training or ability. I mean, I was like that. I'm only successful in whatever way I am successful is because I've stuck at it for 20 years and I've learned all of the mistakes. I mean, I never went to business school or any of these other things that you're supposed to do to be able to open the door and know what to do.
Mm-hmm. There's, I know, some division of feeling in terms of what the commercial end of the record industry could be doing for jazz if they wanted to. And I know that some people think if there were more ads taken out for jazz musicians, if there was more money spent on promotion, that jazz records would sell better. Whereas other people think that it's just simply not the popular music of this time and that it's not going to sell millions of records like rock and roll records mm-hmm. will. But so what? It should be supported anyways. And the people who do want to hear it should have the option of being able to find the records and hear the concerts, and the musicians should be able mm-hmm. to stay alive and be playing their music. What do you think? Do you think that it would be more popular if there was more money spent on advertising?
I think it would be marginally more popular. I don't think that that most kinds of jazz music will ever be like a mass popular music. But there's no doubt that if a major record company did invest some money, that there would be an improvement in what happens. But in terms of, I don't think that they could take a straight ahead jazz record and turn it into a hit by spending $50,000 in a promotion campaign.
What sells with your records? Have you noticed any trends as to what makes one of the Sackville records more popular than the others?
Not really. Mostly, I find that more recently, now that we have more access to the public through better distribution, especially in the United States, that whether it's a solo trombone record by George Lewis or a Buddy Tate, Jay McShann record, they actually sell about the same. and they've both sold, you know, by our terminology, reasonably well. I would think that by the terminology of major companies, though, it would be considered to be a disaster. But of course, we don't have the kind of overheads that they have. You know, we don't have a corporate building and 200 people on, you know, on staff and all that other stuff that they need to generate money to keep going.
Mm-hmm. Let's listen to a selection from one of the albums that you've produced. If you're just joining us, my guest is John Norris, who's the owner of a record store in Canada, the publisher of Coda Magazine, which is a jazz publication that's based in Canada but is circulated more or less around the world, I think. Mm. And he's also the co-owner, co-producer of Sackville Records. We're going to hear a selection from one of the records now. Now, I'd mentioned that Coda and Sackville is involved with different types of jazz, the avant-garde and the more traditional and mainstream ends as well. This is an example of a record I'd consider to be more towards the avant-garde of jazz. You could tell us your thoughts on this.
I would say it's definitely an avant-garde record, a record of two multi-instrumental saxophone players playing music of their own composition without a rhythm section is definitely music that's not to everybody's taste. It's definitely something that's very contemporary.
We're going to hear from Roscoe Mitchell and Anthony Braxton in a duet setting in just a moment. Let me ask you first, John, as the producer or co-producer of this record, what did you see your role as being? What did you take it upon yourself to do, and what did you decide to not do?
When we make a recording, most of our work is done before we go into the studio. It's deciding that we would like to record a certain musician, and I should mention that all of the people that we've recorded are all people that we know personally. They're not somebody that we pick up a telephone and say, you know, listen, I really like your music and I'd like to make a record. We first of all get to know the people, you know, as people, and so that there is a mutual respect and trust built up. And generally speaking, the musician is totally in control of the music in the studio. We might make suggestions, or, you know, if there's some discussion about what's happening with the particular piece of music. But in general, I sit back and listen to them making music and making. We have a first-class engineer, so you don't have to worry about the sound. And generally speaking, the musicians are the people who decide what is going to take place in the studio. With the older musicians, we might have a mutual discussion about the repertoire.
Yeah, because you have some concept albums, you might call them, like the Jay McShann tribute to Fats Waller that we opened the show with.
We asked Jay to do that. And after a great deal of humming and hawing, he agreed to do it. Because first of all, he thought that we wanted him to make a record playing like Fats Waller. But as soon as I said, no, you know, I just want you to play your own way, but to play those tunes. It's partly a way to get musicians of his stature and length of time in the music field to play something different rather than to play the same tunes, which they do all the time, which I think is important, that the musician play fresh material.
Let's listen to a selection from the duet album with Roscoe Mitchell and Anthony Braxton. We'll be hearing a very short piece from this album, and this actually has a name to it, unlike many of Braxton's recent pieces. A lot of his recent stuff is just a schematic figure, but this is also called Lion Fine, Lion 7. Thank you. was Anthony Braxton along with Roscoe Mitchell, and I mentioned that this composition had a name to it instead of just being a schematic. Well, there was indeed a good reason for that. It was actually a composition by Roscoe Mitchell and not Anthony Braxton. The Braxton pieces actually are just little schematic schematic diagrams. John, you were saying that as a producer of this record and the other records you've produced, that you basically help organize the concept for the date and decide who is going to be recorded. But once the session starts, you sit back and listen and just make sure everything goes smoothly. In a situation like this, where most of the pieces are probably really improvisations.
Well, actually, a lot of this music is written out on this record. In fact, most of the recordings that we've made of contemporary musicians, a fair percentage of what they've done is quite highly structured. We actually have not, partly because we don't care too much for music which is just, you know, totally improvised off, you know, from the top of the piece. I don't think that that kind of music is very successful on record. For instance, Sam Rivers is a very talented and gifted musician, and the trio that he had with Dave Holland and Barry Altshuler was very exciting to hear in person. But their concept of playing music was to set up and start playing. And they might be lucky one day, or they might not be lucky, depending on how they feel and what happens. But I think in terms of it being on a record, I personally don't find it to be that interesting.
So you mostly organize dates in which there is a sense of composition.
Yes, an order. I think that for music to communicate to other people, it has to have something for people to put their finger on and to be able to relate to, other than just being a demonstration of somebody's virtuosity as a musician.
Well, sometimes people really exalt the spontaneous, lengthy improvisation where there is no compositional base that the musicians are taking off from, and some people see that as really being the purest form of jazz because it's completely improvisation. I guess you wouldn't agree with that. At least sometimes you wouldn't.
Not in terms of repeated listening. I don't think so. I always thought that jazz at the Philharmonic was boring, for the same reason. But that's my concept of how I like to listen to music. But I feel that there are a lot of other people out there who feel the same way. So with what we do, we're trying to provide a satisfaction for them.
Do you want to know the material before it ends up on record? Do you want to hear the musicians perform it or see the music yourself?
No. I have a great deal of respect for musicians like Braxton and Roscoe Mitchell and Anthony Davis and Julius Hemphill and Oliver Lake. They are all experienced musicians. They are all highly talented. It's not like recording people who've just come out of Berkeley or something like that. These are people who, to quote the title of a new record by Dizzy and Count Basie, they are the gifted ones. And they know what they're going to do. They know they have control over their music to the extent that they realize that when they're making a record that it should be, you know, it's an important occasion.
Do you usually agree on what comprises a good take and when something should be done over and when it should be left as is?
Usually, with the more contemporary musicians, they know when it's no good, and they're most likely to say, "Well, let's do another one now," before, or they may say, "Well, maybe we should listen to this. Maybe we can fix it up, or maybe we should do it again." Most of the older musicians tend to expect you to make that decision for them, which I suspect is as a result of them having had to perform in the past for major companies, and where the producer was in charge, was the boss man, so to speak, and they aren't used to being able to make those kind of value judgments about their music.
The two musicians that we've, well, three actually, that we've heard from, but specifically Anthony Braxton and Jay McShann, have also been recording for major record labels. Mm-hmm. Jay McShann has at least two albums recently done on Atlantic. Yeah. And Braxton's been recording for Arista Records. Right. Does that affect a musician's willingness to record for Sackville, which is a very well-respected record label but doesn't have the commercial clout of Arista or Atlantic? And are there any contractual problems that you're going to enter into with the major record companies if you want to record someone who they're also recording?
So far, there hasn't been a problem. I suspect that that it would not be possible for us to record Anthony as a leader, you know, totally by himself at this particular point. Although I would also suspect that probably we could get permission from Arista through Michael Cuscuna to, if there was a project that we wanted to do with Anthony, which they weren't interested in doing. But with Jay, I don't think that he doesn't have a contract with Atlantic, and many of these contracts actually only apply to the United States. Once you get out of the country, you know, unless a company is making a really big commitment, which Arista has done with Anthony Braxton, and it's to his advantage not to jeopardize that involvement, because they have made it possible for him to do quite a number of very expensive projects that would not be possible otherwise. And I'm sure that from Arista's point of view, they are not financially that successful.
Mm-hmm.
But they must recognize, you know, the musical, the worth of doing it, I guess.
John, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about the jazz scene in Canada, but I thought that before we started talking about that, we could listen to a record that you produced with two Canadian musicians, guitarist Ed Bickert and bass player Don Thompson. Would you tell us a little bit about these two musicians before we hear a selection from this record?
Well, Ed Bickert is probably one of the three or four top guitar players in the conventional sense in the world, along with people like Jim Hall and Barney Kessel and Jimmy Rainey. And Ed has been playing professionally in Toronto since at least the middle 1950s. In fact, during that time, he had numerous offers to go on the road with American musicians and declined them all because he wanted to stay in Toronto and raise a family and not travel. But now that his kids are grown and everything, and now that he's no longer interested in the kind of music that is available in studios, he made his living as a studio musician for quite some time, he's become much more active again as a player. And he's on a number of records with Paul Desmond, and he toured Japan earlier this year with Milt Jackson. And he's becoming, you know, a well-known guitar player outside of Canada. In fact, Canada has three or four world-class jazz guitar players. Lenny Brose, Canadian, Sonny Greenwich is, and Nelson Simons is a guitar player in Montreal who is plays a little bit like Wes Montgomery and has been around for a long time but has never made any records. Musicians who go to Montreal know about him.
Mm-hmm.
And Don Thompson is from Vancouver and was part of the John Handy Band in the middle 1960s. He and Terry Clark, the drummer, worked with John Handy. And since then, he's been in Toronto and is one of the most sort of in-demand musicians. He's a great bass player and a great piano player and is also a drummer, a vibraphone player. And if you want him to be, he'll be a saxophone player. They're very talented people.
Okay, well, let's listen to a selection from an album that you recently co-produced with Ed Bickert and Don Thompson on Sackville Records, and we'll hear Walking My Baby Back Home. guitarist Ed Bigot with Don Thompson on bass, Walking My Baby Back Home, from a recent duet recording that they did together on Sackville Records. My guest, John Norris, is the co-producer of that record and the co-owner of Sackville Records, as well as being the publisher of Coda Magazine, a jazz publication based in Canada, and as well as being the owner of a record shop in Toronto. We've been talking about different aspects of his work in jazz and some of his reactions to the more commercial end of jazz, and as well as his reactions to some of the music. We've been talking a little bit about Canadian jazz musicians. We've just heard two of the musicians that are based in Canada. I know that Canada's been being pretty nationalistic in the past few years, in the sense of making a real effort to get Canadians' music played on the air. Let's face it, it's I guess American and British rock stars that have been making the biggest dents on the international pop charts. And I know that on the CBC there's really been a lot of efforts made to make sure that when a Canadian artist, recording artist, makes a record, that there's a place for that record on the radio. And there's been a lot of criticism of America for its almost cultural imperialism, for its exportation of culture into Canada. With jazz, you're into a pretty unique situation, since jazz really got started in America, and although it's been picked up all around the world, its base is largely in America. What kind of balance do you want to see between Canada really paying attention to its own musicians and devoting its energy to nurturing its own musicians, and to being receptive to American jazz?
Well, first of all, I think that if Canada did not if it didn't institute a policy of insisting that AM radio stations play 30% of Canadian music, there would be hardly any Canadian music recorded. Since the advent of that ruling, Canadian popular like rock music has proliferated. The number of recordings that have been made by people who have money, who have made a big investment, and the results are, I can't think of most of the names of the groups, but they now are known internationally, which would never ever have happened before. With jazz music, it's a little different. It has, as a spin-off, made it much more possible for Canadian jazz recordings to be made by anybody other than the CBC, which is the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which is a government, it's a crown corporation, which means that it functions independently of government but is totally funded by government. And for a number of years, they have been making recordings of Canadian jazz, which they then export as a cultural information service primarily. The records, the only way you can buy them is through the mail, which is sort of a bit ridiculous in terms of getting the musicians popular. But I think as a result of all this activity, it's made it possible for us not only to record Canadian artists, but also to have the records become popular in Canada. Most of the sales of the Canadian recordings are inside Canada, and they sell enough to pay for the production of the recording, which is important to be able to keep continuing to do it. But I think that for Canada to totally isolate itself from whatever is going on elsewhere, especially in jazz, would be a disaster. Jazz is American music, and without the constant interaction and experience of playing with American musicians, being able to hear them and being able to see the American experience, if you like, would mean that we would produce musicians and music that might sound like jazz but would be further removed from the reality of what jazz music is in America. I'm thinking of how stilted, and I come from England originally, how stilted most English jazz musicians are until they come to America and find the reality of what jazz music is, because mostly they learn jazz music from records, especially the older musicians, because from the mid-30s to the mid-50s, American musicians couldn't play in England. And it created a very... No, there was a big hassle with the musicians' union, and it was originally... It started to do with Ray Noble had a dance band in the 30s that came to the United States, and the American government or the immigration department wouldn't give them a work permit. So in the end, Ray Noble and two other people toured America with American musicians, and in retaliation to that, the British Musicians Union wouldn't allow American musicians to work. And that didn't end until the middle 50s.
Hmm.
The only way an American musician could come into England during that period was as an accompanist to a singer who was a variety artist, which was different.
So you think that it's really crucial that American jazz be given a lot of radio play in Canada. Do you think that it's difficult for Canadian musicians to develop a reputation outside of Canada, or do you think that they're on a pretty equal footing? In other words, that they're judged on their music like anybody else is in the country that they're from?
No, I think it's very difficult for them. I think that, and understandably, Americans are going to play music by Americans, and in the same way that there are European musicians who are very famous in their own countries but who aren't known either in Canada or the United States. But Canadian musicians, one of the problems of Canada's nationalism is that Canada is making it much more difficult for American musicians to come into Canada to play from the way it used to be. And most universities and public-sponsored or funded organizations are no longer hiring American entertainment. They're using the money to sponsor Canadian groups, which is fine. But it means that a lot of music that is less popular... It's not as easy, for instance, for say someone like Cecil Taylor to play in Canada, because his popularity is not immense. So the best way for him to perform in Canada is to be hired by a university, but they no longer want to hire non-Canadian talent for their major concerts. But conversely, it's extremely difficult for Canadian musicians to work in the States. And it's always been that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's always been extremely difficult for Canadians to get a work permit. Even Oscar Peterson has had problems at various times working in the States.
You're in an interesting position as far as the business end of the music. When you're in a business and you're selling something and producing something that you really care about, you can... either become less commercial about the whole enterprise, or you can justify doing almost everything because you really care about it. You can justify hyping to no end. You can justify really pushing your records onto other people and using all the muscle that you can to coerce radio stations into playing it because you care about the musicians, you care about the music. So it would be different from someone who's just interested in mm-hmm. making monetary profit off the airplay of it. What do you think about when you do that? What's your attitude towards getting the records you've produced radio play and towards getting your records sold in stores and placed in stores?
Well, I feel that I certainly couldn't go out and sell a radio station or a store to carry the records with the kind of usual kind of hype. Fortunately, we have distributors who actually put the records into stores. I would find that very difficult to do that. But when I'm in the States now, and when I'm spending more time in the States, because I feel it's important, for instance, to come on and talk on radio stations like this when the opportunity arises. But I hopefully don't feel that I've changed how I feel about the music in terms of communicating with people. If I had to hype something to somebody, I'll probably turn around and walk out of the store. Mm-hmm. If I can't talk to the person, if they aren't interested in jazz, I really don't have any way of communicating successfully with them. Fortunately, there are lots of stores and lots of radio stations that have people who like jazz music. So usually there isn't too much of a problem. But having worked in a big record store and all this kind of thing, I also understand that it's unrealistic for me to expect a store to carry 25 copies of a Jay McShann record unless he's performing in town or something like that. I mean, it's crazy to expect that a store is going to buy all your records when most stores operate on a budget and they've got so much money to spend on all the different aspects of what they carry. And if you can just get a representation, you know, then you're doing well.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you a little bit about some of the risks that you've taken going into business independently, and that's really like three businesses, mm-hmm. record production, music journal, and music store. Usually, I think when you enter into business independently, you take some risks, and you never know which risks are the wrong risks, and which risks are the ones that really pay off. Would you have any things to tell us that might specifically be applicable to other people who are have been or about to get in a similar independent situation?
Well, obviously the biggest problem for everybody is money, you know. And when we started out, all of these things sort of grew. One led to another. I started the magazine, you know, with nothing. We've never ever borrowed any money to finance any of like major functions. I once borrowed some money from my wife to record The Man from Muskogee by Jay McShann, but that was because she was crazy about excuse me, about the band, and said, well, I'll lend you the money. But when we started the record store, it was more of an accident than anything else that enabled us to start it. And I think we put $300 each in, and I had some used records. But I had already worked in a record store for 8 years, and I knew all of the people in the record companies, the distributors, and they were all willing to give me credit because I already knew all of them. But we've never, ever started a business in the conventional way. When we started Sackville, we recorded a band called the Jazz Giants simply because I liked the band, and there were other people who liked the band. And originally in Sackville, there were five other people who were jazz fans who each put up, you know, say $1,000 or something. I think we started with $5,000 when we made the Jazz Giants record. And eventually, those other people, they really weren't interested in being involved in a record company or anything like that. They just did it because they liked the idea. And so eventually, you know, we bought them out. But it was, you know, we made a record without really knowing how to sell it or even thinking in terms of whether we would sell enough to pay for it or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. You're in three different aspects of jazz, mm-hmm. Record production, store ownership, and music journal publication. Do you ever see that as being involved in conflicting interests? Because if you wanted to, you could produce a record, sell it, and promote it simultaneously.
Well, I think it's an advantage. And I don't feel that we're a monopoly in that sense. We would be a monopoly if we ignored the efforts of other people, you know, in the magazine or in the store, if we said, well, that we don't like what you're doing, so we aren't going to write about it, or we aren't going to carry your records in our store. But hopefully, you know, that kind of, we would never feel like that way about the efforts of somebody else that's trying to do the same kind of thing that we're doing. Mm-hmm. But I think having a magazine is a definite asset for us, because we've sort of built our own community of people. Like the people who subscribe and read Coda regularly, I think most of those people also feel that they're part of, you know, part of a community, and they support us by buying records from us in lots of cases. They come to our store in the summertime. We get many, many people from the United States and from Europe coming over, and specifically coming to Toronto as part of a holiday, just so that they can come to the Jazz and Blues Center and visit us, and see the place where all this stuff comes from, and what we're like, I guess, as, you know, as people. And I think that's more compensation than if, say, we You know, we sold 100,000 copies of the magazine instead of 5,000 or something like that. But publishing a jazz magazine is a really, it's crazy to do it. I mean, if anybody's thinking of starting a jazz magazine, you know, unless you've got a rich uncle who's willing to...
Well, you're subsidized by the Canadian
right,
Arts
that's
Council.
Right, yeah.
It's
that,
not
that,
obviously a big profit-making operation.
No, no.
Well, John, I really wish you continued success in the work you've been doing.
Thank
you've certainly made a lot of contributions to jazz, and I wish you continued success, and I wish you the best. We're going to hear another selection from an album that you've produced for Sackville, and this is the South African pianist and composer Dalla Brand, also known as Abdullah Ibrahim, who we feature frequently here on Fresh Air. Tell us a little bit about recording him. It must have been a nice experience.
Well, Dalla is so fantastic. I knew about him long before he came to the United States because a friend of mine is from Cape Town and he's an amateur bass player. And he used to play with Dalla. They used to have a club where they used to have jam sessions on Sunday nights before the government insisted that Cape Town racially separate itself. And they used to have jam sessions, and he gave me records that Dalla had made in South Africa back in the 50s. And it had long been, you know, I always wanted to hear Dalla play. And so finally, he was doing some workshops sponsored by JCOA in New York. So I flew down just to go to this big band workshop and, you know, met Dalla for the first time as a result of that. But we had already talked on the telephone because through this association with Joe. And at that time when I met him, we decided that he should come to Toronto and do some concerts and that, you know, and make a record. And this is the first recording that Dalla made in North America. He had recorded it for Reprise in the middle 1960s in Europe. But this was the first recording that he had made in North America. And it was just like a concert. I mean, Dalla Brand is fantastic. He just sits down at the piano and all this incredible music just comes flowing out of him. And we ran the recording session like a concert. He played three sets and we had about 50 people in the studio, though you'd never know it because there's no applause on the record. But there were about 50 people in the studio. And the only request, I made two requests from Dalla, one of which he agreed to and the other one, he also agreed to, but he actually didn't do it. I asked him not to play any pieces that he had recorded previously, and that didn't happen. But the versions that he did for us are so fantastic that it doesn't matter. And the other was that in concert, he usually plays anywhere from 40 to 60 minutes nonstop. And we explained to him that it's a drag to have to turn a record over in the middle of a piece of music. And that if he could please try to play no more than about 23 or 24 minutes, you know, at a time. And that, so he said, oh, sure, that's no problem. He said, just put up a sign in the glass, you know, of the control room when it's 20 minutes, he said, and then I will know that I have to, you know, end it soon. So, oh, this is great. You know, there's not going to be any problem. So he sits down, we start. And, of course, when he plays, he closes his eyes. He's out in... When he really gets playing, he's in a trance. I mean, he isn't seeing or there's nothing. He's just looking out into space and playing. I'm sure that when he's playing, he's thinking about his home and about South Africa and all the experiences that all these songs, you know, relate to his personal life. And so at 20 minutes, we put the sign up in the window, think, no, this isn't going to work. He's just going to keep going. Every piece ended around 22 or 23 minutes at the most. It was as if he had a clock inside his head which told him when it was time to stop.
It's a nice story. Well, we'll hear a piece that's times out at about 11 minutes. This is it's called Fats, Duke, and the Monk. We'll hear Dalla Brand at the piano. John Norris, thank you so much for being here this afternoon on Fresh Air. John Norris has joined us on his way back to Canada from Washington, D.C. He is the co-owner, co-producer of Sackville Records, the publisher of Coda Magazine, a Canadian-based jazz publication, and the owner of a record shop that's located in Toronto. Thanks again so much for being here.
Thank you, Terry. I really enjoyed it, and all best wishes, you know, for the show and for the station. Just keep doing what you're doing. It's terrific. We need this kind of radio to enable the music to continue to be heard by the public.
Thank you, John. Okay. This is Fresh Air. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.
Thank you.
a piece called Fats Duke and the Monk with Della Brand at the piano from a Sackville album called Sangoma. This is Fresh Air. It's 7 minutes after 3 o'clock. You're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. The lead story in the September issue of Playboy is called Girls of the Ivy League. It's subtitled, Coeds from America's Most Prestigious Schools Help Playboy Prove That Beauty and Brains Are Not Mutually Exclusive, unquote. Maybe you remember the way the Penn campus reacted when Playboy photographer David Chan advertised for women students willing to pose for this Playboy feature. Some women came to pose. Others were outraged and wanted to keep this symbol of sexism off the campus. Some women intentionally decided to not demonstrate against Playboy and to not debate with Playboy because they felt that Playboy was not worth expending the energy on. So this month, 12 pages of Playboy are devoted to the women who did pose and to Playboy's account of the controversy. A few women from Penn are featured in this series. One of the women, Laura Kleber, is featured nude. I've asked Laura to join us and to talk with us about why she decided to pose and to talk with us about what types of reactions she's gotten now that her picture's in print. Laura, welcome to Fresh Air. I'm glad you were able to be here.
Hi.
Before we get to your reactions to seeing all this in print now, let me ask you, when Chan first came to the campus, I guess it was late winter or early spring, as I recall.
Yeah, it was in February, I think.
What did you decide to pose? What did you think about, and how did you arrive at the decision to really do it?
Well, I saw the ad in the school newspaper.
What did the ad say, do you remember?
Something about Playboy's looking for a cross-section of women for their September issue.